Hello, and welcome to Castle Talk, where we talk to writers and creators of today's genre worlds. I'm your host, Jason Henderson, publisher at Castlebridge Media, home of the Castle of Horror anthology series. Tonight, we're chatting with Catherine Hall Page, who returns with her latest novel in the Faith Fairchild series, The Body in the Web, which comes out the 30th of May. So this month, this is, what number in the Faith Fairchild series is this?
This is number 26, in fact.
Goodness gracious, number 26. But what really sets it apart, you and I talked about your last novel, is that this novel also covers the beginning of and the experience of the pandemic. So before I say hi, Catherine Hall Page is the author of 25 previous Faith Fairchild mysteries, the first of which received an Agatha Award. She also won an Agatha for the short story The Would-Be Widower. She's a recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award at Malice Domestic, nominated for an Edgar Mary Higgins Clark Award, the McCavity Award, and she lives in Lincoln, Massachusetts, with her husband, Anne Dirile, Maine. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you, Jason. I should say that, we're recording before the 30th, and today is, in fact, the 17th of May, which is Norwegian Constitution Day, and I am half Norwegian, so this is a very celebratory day for us. And I don't know, Henderson, there might be some little Nordic things there. I don't know, but this is a big day for us.
Yeah. Well, first of all, happy Norwegian Constitution Day. I would not be at all surprised. I've done my DNA once before, and I found that my DNA stretches like all the way like from Ireland to, you know, Norway. And it's just like a narrow sort of sort of oval that just
there was a lot of going back and forth there.
I mean, it's really a narrow part of the globe. So the body in the web. You and I were talking about this a little bit before. You've got your long running character. This must have been, I can only imagine, this must have been deeply like heartfelt for you, because your character of Faith Fairchild, who has been around for these 25 previous novels, in this novel, at the beginning of it, her sister calls her up and she says, in a really wonderful, wonderful phone call, she says, your life is about to change. Go out and I know some people in the government. Your life's about to change. Go out and buy hand sanitizer and toilet paper and all the things you're about, because everything's about to lock down. Your world's about to be completely different. Yeah. And it's just such a specific thing to have happen it's such a historical thing, but it's happening in the moment. Talk to me about visiting Faith Fairchild with this real world pandemic.
Well, I wasn't writing the book during the pandemic. For one thing, I was extremely busy. Our adult son moved back in March 2020, happily, and then and worked remotely until May 2021. We three were a pod, and in terms of, I kept calling it, foraging, kind of going out to get food or supplies or do, whatever. And I talk about that in the book quite a bit and more in the author's note. But what I did do was I kept a kind of a journal every day. I would jot down a few things that I thought were really odd.
Yeah.
This is really appropriate for this podcast, is because there were so many bizarre things that were happening.
Like what? I mean, you mentioned, for instance, we were wiping down groceries when we brought them back.
We were washing groceries. All of a sudden you couldn't get, forget about toilet paper. You couldn't get yeast.
Yeah.
You couldn't get, all sorts of.
And everybody was baking bread. What the hell was that about? That was the interesting thing. Not only you couldn't get yeast. Yeah. And everybody suddenly was on Facebook going, hey, I pulled out the bread maker that I got I got married, and like literally ours was a wedding gift. And we pulled out the bread maker too, because I guess we're just lemmings yes.
So there was that sense of life being turned upside down, and not in a good way. So when I did come to write the book, I had all these notes, and in some ways we can talk about this more. I mean, we were very fortunate, because none of the three of us got COVID. Actually, my son and I finally got COVID just in December this year, mild cases. Masked all the time, boosted to the hilt. And finally, you know, Christmas Eve, we tested positive this last Christmas. But, you know, we did lose a family member to it. There were other things that happened. And so there was this constant, but yet there was also the feeling of some kind of, there were just a whole lot of things I didn't have to do that I used to have to do, or places I had to go, or, you know, because you had a really ready-made excuse there. And I've heard this from a lot of people, that it was sort of, oh, okay, sorry, no, cannot see you, cannot do that. And then it was, my son was working remotely, so, you know, he was busy. And, but when he wasn't, we found that it was, we were going and exploring places that we had never gone to in the state. Just to kind of get out and be about, and especially in the different national and local parks and wildernesses. And we weren't so much binge watching TV, but we were watching a lot of old movies. And then of course, you know, I was reading a lot, but again, I was busy, you know, in terms of the cooking and the, all of those everyday chores, it was happy in some odd ways.
Well, I mean, it's so complicated. And when I look back on that era that is still sort of petering out,
we're still in the time of COVID. We're going to be in the time of COVID forever.
But that particular lockdown period was such a weird experience because of just all of the pure, and one of the things I love that you actually explore in this mystery is that there's about a murder, but in the small town going on, you've got people who are kind of benefiting, like you're talking about, where they're already introverts, and so it's fine. And then people who are a family, and they're driving each other crazy because they're living in a small house and they can't get away from one another.
Yes.
And you know, and then there's you have characters who you know, Faith Fairchild is getting in her catering business is.
Tanks.
You get to touch on that because I remember that weddings getting canceled left and right, you know, but at the same time, she's also organizing a delivery service because there are vulnerable people out there who've lost all of their access to the outside world.
Yeah.
There's just so much. I really love how you took all this stuff and sort of put it into one. Did you feel freed in a sense from like the usual outline of a mystery novel when you started doing this? I mean, that you had more to say essentially so you could stack the front?
Yeah, because the body doesn't show up. And there's only one body until really quite a ways into the book. And, you know, there's supposedly these rules, which, you know, were made to be broken, but still, you know, pretty much. And I write a traditional mystery. You have to have a body pretty soon, like if not in the first chapter and definitely in the second. And this one doesn't, you know, it doesn't occur until quite a ways and one of the things about this book is that it exemplifies the whole notion is that everything in the present is buried in the past. So that's true of
what does that mean? I mean,
The case of this, it's that the person, the victim, the reason that she was murdered, you know, all happened long time before the pandemic. I mean, there was that. But a lot of what's going on and what was going on in the pandemic and the way we reacted to it, the way individual people reacted to it, had to do with things that occurred before. I'll give you an example. I ended up knowing three different couples who divorced. And
really?
And
three different people, couples divorced during
different
the pandemic.
Different ages of how long they were married and spread out in other, well, two in Massachusetts, but one someplace else. And, you know, the inclination was to say, well, yeah, the isolation and the just being together and, you know, not being able to go about their normal lives and their jobs or, you know, doing all of that, that's what did it. But then, you know, it's when I began to think about them, you know, you could almost have predicted this because there were clues in the past that they wouldn't be able to weather the storm.
Wow.
And then in other cases, you found that it drew people closer. It drew families closer together. It drew individual people closer together. And, you know, they talk about the pods. I mean, people form pods with people that they really hadn't known very well before the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, neighbors.
Became almost like families. I mean, really, it sounds like such a Pollyanna-ish thing to say, but it's true. You started to treat
Pollyanna has gotten a bad rap. That's a pretty good
point. That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, I know that it was some of the best. That's what's horrible is at the same time that my son, I have to say, was deeply, deeply depressed by the pandemic because he's a big introvert, right? My daughter was a big extrovert. I mean, vice versa. My son was an extrovert, needed people around, felt super depressed. My daughter couldn't have cared less. My wife and I were having a fine time. It was great. We could spend time with exactly. You know, if people weren't actually going through suffering, terrible sadness and tragedy, we would have, you know, you'd unabashedly say those were some of the coolest years we ever had.
And I think that you will look back. I mean, I know that that my husband and I look back at it, and I haven't really talked to my son about it, but I think, you know, he might look back at it. He hated working remotely, though, but because it actually piled on a lot more work even sure. than he usually does. I think that, you know, and then there was also that sense of being in a dome, you know, that we really feel protected. And we were taking all of these precautions. We believed the science. So, you know, we felt safe.
Do you remember the first time that you went out, like, to the grocery store or whatever, wearing a mask? And you mentioned it. You go to the trouble to talk about how first you had the stitching homemade masks.
Yeah,
and then later people started looking for masks online. But do you remember your first experience of going out, like, grocery shopping with the mask and stuff?
Yeah, I do. Because we live within walking distance of it's a community farm, and they immediately, and they have a little farm store, and they sell their own eggs and milk and chicken and some things like that. And Farmer Pete immediately began bringing in things from other farms that didn't have farm stores. And so, and the announcement, and again, you know, we became very reliant on technology for information. I'm not talking about the news outlets so much as, you know, like local information and what was going on. So, you know, it came out and said that Codman Farm was going to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's all the honor system. And so that was the first place that I went to actually wear a mask and go into a closed area. And again, it was something that was stitched up. And of course, we later found out that those masks were really not very safe at all.
No.
They were so pretty. And I mean, we had...
I think I've got a baggie full of them right here, actually. Yeah. Anyway, I do because it's got the little Colorado mask on it and stuff. Yeah,
I saved some of them that were really.
I remember this guy staring at me. I went to the grocery store. No, this was the post office, and there was this guy coming out, older gentleman, and he just glared at me because I was wearing a mask, and he was just so angry. You could tell he was just this was early. This was like right at the beginning, and he just you could tell that he just thought this was bullshit. You mentioned something that I think people will already have forgotten about, which was the grocery store aisles being directed in one direction.
And the little circles that you had to stand in the circle in line.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah. Someday we're going to look at this like, you know, your grandma will haul out you know, coupons for from the Depression and right, everything, and from the rations, war rations.
S&H green stamps. I was thinking about that the other day.
Yeah, and it'll be like that.
It is like that already.
And it feels like almost like, in a sense, if your life is this line,
yeah,
it feels like a part of the line that's missing, like you jumped over it. Sometimes I have a hard time remembering if I think back to like certain things. It's almost as though that's a carved out part of your life, right, that is difficult to access.
It is a part of our lives that, you know, there was a kind of a hiatus where
yeah,
a lot was suspended, and it is, and it's, I have trouble remembering, you know, we're now seeing people, and in some cases there are people that we haven't seen until and since before the pandemic, and I'm thinking, yeah, okay, wait a minute, what year was that? Was that,
yes,
you know, 2021, you know, when was this?
Yeah, it's so, like those years don't, it's like you literally lift them into a whole other timeline. And right, it's just very strange. You, the plot of your book actually comes from another piece of the pandemic that, you know, Zoom became Zoom a thing.
Yeah.
This blows my mind that I knew about Zoom before the pandemic, but nobody ever used the video.
I didn't know anything about Zoom.
It was a business competitor with Skype is the way that I thought of it. Some of the businesses used Skype, and some, yeah, of the businesses used Zoom, and, huh, you know, and some used Microsoft services, whatever their thing was called. And somehow, I think by pricing it free, Zoom just took off. And so if you were going to talk to your grandma in Texas,
right,
Zoom was the way to go. And can you tell me about the Zoom event that affects the teacher who winds up being the victim? I mean, spoilers, but the teacher who winds up being the victim. Yeah. Tell me about that.
And we can also talk about how hard it was for teachers and students.
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, so again, taking all these notes and in the journal, there was a town meeting, not a big town meeting, but it was a relatively small committee meeting when, and during the course of that, it was Zoom bombed, which, mm-hmm, I had not ever heard of a Zoom bombing. And it was not in the book, the victim, the teacher is, there are all of these pictures, you know, pornographic of her, that have been photoshopped, although some date back to when she modeled in art school, you know, for life drawing class, and, you know, so, but she's quite identifiable. In the case, that what triggered all of this and what I had jotted down about was, it was actually a racial attack.
Oh, really?
Yeah. On one of the committee members. And the thing that struck me afterwards when I talked, not just to my son who is in IT, but to someone else I knew he was the guy who would know more about the technicalities, is that you could be anywhere, any place, and do this to somebody. I mean, you could be out of the country to Zoom bomb. You could be next door to Zoom bomb.
Of course, yeah.
And so that immediately began to trigger all sorts of plot,
yes,
devices for me.
By the way, I saw one of these happen. I Daniel Trussoni, who's a reviewer at the New York Times, and also a novelist, she was doing a seminar about writing, and this is early days of Zoom during the pandemic, and somebody came on and asked, raised his hand to ask a question, and then moved, yeah, the group, and then her tech person quickly moved to like eject the guy from the Zoom.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did actually see this happen, yeah, you know, and
I mean, I haven't actually, but I went online to look at examples, and oh wow, you know, some of them are really, really scary, you know, very appropriate for Castle of Horror. I mean, there are,
yeah,
some really, really frightening stuff out there.
Oh, yeah,
examples of Zoom bombing, if you just Google examples of,
but the one you come up with, and let's talk about teachers, yeah, for a second, the one you'd come up with, you have a teacher who's presenting, and then somebody, as you said, you know, breaks in, is able to take over sharing during Zoom, and everybody listening now knows exactly what we're talking about. Take over sharing and just shows an array of photos, many of them photoshopped of the teacher and some from early modeling days. And it's all meant to humiliate this, this teacher. And first of all, things were really tough for teachers during, I mean, if you had a kid, they were probably tougher. I mean, the kids sitting at home, but for teachers, it was madness. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It was madness. And I talked to, well, I was a teacher for many, many years before, you know, because this is a second career for me. I was 40 when the first Faith Fairchild was published. And before that, I'd been a high school teacher and a high school administrator, and that was going to be the trajectory of my life. And then I wrote that book while my husband was on sabbatical, and the rest is this kind of- But the whole point is that I knew exactly how she would have felt. And also, I mean, the fact is, and it's a small town, this fictitious town west of Boston, Aylfer, and the moderator is kind of, he doesn't know what to do. He's not tech savvy. So, you know, it takes him a while to shut down. You know, meanwhile, Faith's son, who's home from college, is, you know, screaming, you know, shut it down, get him out, you know, all of this.
It's just so horrible. Oh, my God. It's
horrible. Yeah. And of course, the town, you know, people are very sympathetic, but yet there's also this whole sense, and this I think is true about any of these things, is that people like, well, there's, you know, there's no smoke without fire, that and so she, you know, so she resigns, you know, I won't tell the ending of the book, but in any case, I mean, she knows that she can't continue, you know, she can't continue to teach, even though there are huge amounts of support, there's still always that whisper campaign, which is as bad as the Zoom bombing.
Yes. I you know, it strikes me that you've written what you could almost call a cozy, I mean, it's a little sexier than a typical cozy mystery, but a cozy mystery that involves all of this material about the pandemic. But that humiliation right there could be the key to anything, like a domestic thriller. There's a million, because it's so gripping, you know. We all you know, we consider ourselves lucky if something like that's not happening to us, but reading about it happening to somebody is just absolutely really addictive.
And so that's why you know that Faith is the only person who, because she, this is someone who's a very good friend, dear friend, and Faith is the only person who is convinced it was murder. But everyone else is, you know, this was obviously a suicide.
Because the fact that it involves sex is one of those things that makes people always super suspicious, which is just, as a New Englander, you know this better than most, you know, but it's like, Jesus. Hey,
I'm a Jersey girl. Come on.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But I mean, that's what, you know, even going back to, I think you and I have talked about Peyton Place in the past.
Yes.
I you know, and in other words, it's like that particular kind of persnickety judgmentalism is just never good. It's like it's in the bone somehow, you know.
we're really seeing a lot of it now. I mean, yeah. You know, get into the whole banning books thing and pointing fingers and all of what's going on now. But it's
I'm shocked by it, by that. I mean, I don't want to, you know, this isn't a particularly, it shouldn't be political to say that we shouldn't be in the business of banning books, not from libraries, you know. Calls to defund libraries, you know, in small towns in Texas and Florida and elsewhere are just frankly shocking to me. I just thought, growing up in the 70s, I really thought that we were past all that.
No, I've written about this a lot, and I mean, I really think that the libraries and librarians are frontline guardians of our freedoms and democracy. If you look back over the years, the role that they've played and continue to play. I'm very, very big and feisty librarians. I don't know any librarians who go around shushing people. I know librarians who refuse to shred, who shred patrons records and refused to hand them over to, what was his name? Haig?
Rumsfeld?
One of those guys. They kind of blend all into one.
They do after a while, don't they? It's just a big sort of amorphous blob of gray suits. And and that hasn't changed. That's
hilarious. But in addition to, you know, the teachers and the kids, you know, all my my niece is a nurse practitioner, and it was hell on her. And all the people that I knew who in the healthcare field, it was horrific for them because of not just the fatigue, kind of emotional and physical fatigue, but what they were having to deal with every day and what they saw. So that's why the book is dedicated to them, along with teachers and also to my husband. I hadn't dedicated a book to him since the first one. I thought it was time.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really lovely. I think you saw when I posted online, I was reading it.
Yep.
The book that this reminded me of, if this makes any sense, is a book called Wildfire at Night, which came out in 1956. Mary Stuart's Wildfire at Night. What was interesting about that is it is a murder mystery that takes place during the coronation.
Yes.
But not literally at the coronation, but they've all fled to the mountains just to get away from the traffic of the coronation.
Right.
But the reason I thought about it is it's this very important time, but the book is not about that. But that is the thing that is shaping everybody's lives. And I thought, this is going to be, if I were to put together like a stack of like four or five novels that are like that, this is now one. In the same way, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is really about the Blitz.
It is.
And about getting away from the Blitz. And this is, you know.
I'm honored. Yeah. Mary Stuart was an amazing writer, lived to be 98. And her most famous book is called, and it was her first book, Madam, Will You Talk? That And I can remember reading that when I was about 12, 13. And it just, it was the first actual romantic suspense.
Oh yeah.
Book written, and
that's amazing. You know, that's amazing. Yeah. So she invented a genre.
Yeah. But she was incredibly versatile. She also wrote these Arthurian novels, medieval fantasy.
On my Facebook, that's what she's known for. Like when I mention this person, everybody goes, "Oh yeah, Mary Stuart, she wrote those Arthurian books."
Which were great, but you know, and this, Shetland, the Hebrides are very hot now because of the wonderful Anne Cleves series, Shetland, which I adored, this is set on one of the Hebrides on the Isle of Skye. Yeah, and so you know, you couldn't get much more remote than that. But I mean, we were also on our own little islands, you know.
Yes. Yeah, you've turned, you know, the funny thing is, because it's a pandemic book, and again, that's a small genre. I mean, the small genre here is books that are marked by the pandemic without being about the pandemic per se. Yeah. And that's, I think, that's what I love the most about it is I think 20 years from now, people are going to really enjoy this book because of that.
The book isn't out yet, but there have been a couple of, you know, Library Journal and Booklist, they got them and gave them starred reviews. And that's what they're mentioning. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is zeroing in on the app, the pandemic aspect to it, which really made me happy about it. I mean, I wanted it to be a backdrop, but really what else could it be about? I mean, the series is chronological. You don't have to read them in order. They're all could be read as standalones, but you know, I couldn't just skip over this time period in this family's life and, you know, have it be suddenly 2023 and, you know, a vague but distant memory, because it's, you know, that's not going to be true, especially for people my age. You know, it's we have all of these significant dates in our lives, you know, like, the assassinations of King and Kennedy and the Kennedys and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then 9/11, and now this. So there are all these events, and this now has joined those, so that we could say, you know, before and after.
Yeah, I'm just very thankful that it exists for that reason. I really, even though it's a profoundly depressing situation, I just had a great sense of joy reading it because I was so glad that this. This sounds unusually effusive, right? But I was so glad that there is this document of that time told from this particular perspective that I think is just incredibly important. You know, because it's not like the hot zone or something where you've got a bunch of scientists running around doing scientist stuff. Instead, it's, you know, in this case, it's a preacher's wife who cooks. And speaking of the cooking, this is something else that people should know about that I just find so wonderful and beyond my ken, right?
Okay.
Is that, as you mentioned, since Faith is a caterer, she and her catering business is cratering, but she's, you know, whatever, she's dealing with it. But whenever you mention something, you actually have a parenthesis that says recipe on page whatever.
Yeah,
and
yes,
the recipes are in the back.
But, so yeah, because I didn't want them to interrupt the narrative.
I didn't
put recipes in the first bunch of books, because actually there was a writer named Virginia Rich who did that, and I thought, well, you know, she's doing that. And and it just, you know, and then people began writing to me wanting recipes, and my editor at the time, she said, you know, you should put the recipes in. But I said, I want them at the end, not to interrupt, not to have Faith find the badly bludgeoned body, and then there's a, you know, super fudge brownie recipe. So, you know,
but
so
that's,
you can
great, because it means the back of the book is a cookbook. That's brilliant.
Yes.
I mean, it's just so, that is so brilliant.
You can make flour, you can make flourless cookies, you know, you can make beer bread, because there was no yeast to be found. I mean, it was really like, in a way, like, drugs, you know, people.
Yeah, you've got sheet pan roasted delicata squash.
Yeah.
Beer bread.
Everybody was doing sheet pan, high temp stuff.
Yes. Yep. I love this, by Faith Fairchild with Catherine Hall Page. That's just brilliant. I love it. Venikiotis Baklava.
Yeah, that's my sister-in-law, her baklava.
Yeah. Love it. First job I ever got fired from, was a Greek restaurant, and we served a lot of baklava.
Okay. Well, it's pretty darn tasty.
I still have fond memories of it. They fired me because they were in a fight with my dad. It was a whole political thing in the tiny town that we lived in.
You were a victim of, you know,
I was a pawn. I was a pawn being moved. but
the beer, the beer bread I'm still making, because I hadn't known about that before.
I love beer bread.
And you can put all sorts of good stuff in it. And it doesn't even have to be alcoholic beer. You can use, you know, non-alcoholic. It needs the carbonation.
Yes. That is just such a brilliant, you know, thought that we have these recipes that were go-tos because of the absence of yeast, which sounds almost religious. I mean, that's brilliant. So anyway, I have to say, so the book is called The Body in the Web, meaning in this case, the web, like Zoom.
Yes.
And it comes out May 30th. So I've really enjoyed talking about it. I wish that you and I talked more, because I always enjoy it.
Yeah. I wish you lived closer, because then we could actually see each other in person.
I know. We could go for one of these walks. I mean,
go for a walk. I could make some flourless cookies.
Yes, please. All right. Well, we will make that happen. Have a great release. I've really enjoyed talking about this
thank
book, and
so
I really enjoyed reading it. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.